Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Over the last couple of years, the news media in the U.S. have faced a series of problems, internal and external. Let's review. A young reporter at the New York Times was discovered fabricating and plagiarizing stories. It was learned a more senior Times reporter had sent an intern out on the road to do some reporting for him. The Times under fire for its reporting on WMD. CBS retracts a story it had aired regarding the president's service in the National Guard. Columnists paid to advance the administration's agenda. A non-journalist with White House press credentials. Packaged news produced for local television by agencies of the federal government. Reporters facing jail time if they fail to reveal the identities of confidential sources. Those are some of the controversies that leaped to mind as I began to prepare for our discussion today. On the program today, we're going to take a look at recent controversies and issues in American journalism. Two guests join us, journalist and media writer Seth Mnookin and the dean of the University of Illinois College of Communications, Ron Yates. Dean Yates is here with me in the studio. He's a former award-winning correspondent and editor for the Chicago Tribune. Joining us by telephone, Seth Mnookin, a former media writer for Newsweek. He is the author of Hard News, The Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Ron Yates, Seth Mnookin, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, sure. Same here.
The scandals we've seen over the last couple of years, the problems, the pressures, do you remember anything like this happening before in recent history, Ron?
Oh, yeah. It's been an ongoing problem. I think I can remember being back during my time at the Chicago Tribune back in the 70s when a columnist was fired for fabricating a couple of columns. Other people were fired for plagiarism. Back in the 80s, an award-winning correspondent for the Chicago Tribune was fired because he ripped off a Reuters story and put it in the paper as his own. So this is nothing new. It's just you would hope that over time it might decrease, and I don't think it's much higher. I mean, I don't think the incidences are any higher than they have been. In fact, there was a poll done, I don't know if it was by a Gallup or when it was, who did it most recently, but it looked at the, going back to 1974 when it first began doing these polls, it looked at the number of how journalists have been rated, and right now, I think less than 25% of the, fewer than 25% of the people who have responded to the survey rated reporters' ethical standards as high or very high. And back in 1974, it had dropped down to, I think in 76, it dropped down to about 16%. And, I'm sorry, 16% in 2000 and 33% in 1976. So it actually was higher back in the 70s than it is now.
Yeah. Seth, what's your sense?
I actually think that probably there's slightly less of it going on now. I'm sorry about that. But the reason that we're hearing about it so much is because there's a much greater level of scrutiny than there ever has been at any other point in history. Not only the mainstream media examining itself, but now you have sort of self-appointed media critics dissecting every dispatch, every article that's going out there, not only for plagiarism, but also for bias or for misquoting or for inaccuracy. I think if you look at the quality of the work overall that's being done today, compared really to any other point, the quality across the board is probably slightly higher. But along with that, you have a culture in which there's a lot more questioning and a lot more examination of everything that goes into print and goes on the air and goes on broadcasts.
You know, we're hearing calls for transparency in media. Is it a good thing or is it problematic?
Well, I think it's a good thing. I mean, as Seth points out, most news organizations today have public editors. A lot of them do, not
right.
all of them, but the New York Times certainly does now, in the Post Jason Blair scandal, and the Tribune has one. It didn't have one when I started there in 1970. It certainly does now, and a lot of major news organizations do, and I think that's the kind of scrutiny that Seth is referring to. Also, I think another area here is that it may seem that it's more prevalent today than ever before because the public itself has access to the internet and it's able to make these, it can do a Google search and say, well, gee, I've seen this story someplace before.
Right.
And suddenly it pops up. Yeah, here it was. It was in the Jerusalem Post. It was in Reuters. It was in UPI, whatever. And that is, it's much easier to track these things down. And of course, it gets rebroadcast. People talk about it a lot. It goes out on the internet. Whereas in the past, if you did it, you might get away with it over, for a period of a year or two till somebody actually saw the plagiarism at some point.
How are the news media dealing with the blogosphere?
I think that we're going to see an evolving relationship. It's not something that certainly the traditional news media has figured out how they want to approach. And right now, there are some legal cases that raise the questions of whether bloggers should be afforded the same kind of protections in a court of law that more quote-unquote traditional journalists are. But I think what we're going to see is a kind of cross-pollination, and we're already starting to see that. The best bloggers realize that they are incredibly dependent on the traditional news media because one guy in his pajamas with a high-speed internet connection doesn't have the training or the resources to do reporting from war zones or to do security reporting or to do investigative reporting. They really rely on the traditional media to comment on what's going on. And then there are other cases, and we saw a great example of that with CBS and Dan Rather, where actually the blogosphere can come in and serve as kind of a check on some stories that the mainstream media are taking part in. So I think that relationship is going to continue to be very fluid, but there are people on the sort of partisans on both sides who say that, we're going to win out and the other side is going to disappear. I don't think that's true.
Ron, you're going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to add to that in terms of the bloggers, et cetera, people have a tendency to believe somehow. Well, first of all, let's put something on the table here. Journalists are not certified. We are not licensed. We don't have any way of saying, hey, you can't do this because you're not a licensed journalist. It's just not done. And the public grants us no franchise. I mean, we are protected under the First Amendment. It's one of about the only business, I guess, that is protected by an amendment to the Constitution. But anybody can say, I'm a journalist and can start writing. And, we have a lot of freelancers out there, a lot of people who are stringers working around the world. I work with many of them myself. And, they do work. And, I think that for people in the mainstream to say, well, this person's not a journalist or whatever, that's stretching the point a little bit. I do
right.
believe, however, that there are people out there who claim to be, they're practicing. They don't have the, let's put it this way, they don't have the training that say a mainstream journalist might have in understanding how to interview, how to understand how to organize a story, write it compellingly, gather information. So what they do is they take information that's already on the internet, they kind of reprocess it, maybe redraft it, rewrite it somehow, and pass it on as truth. You know, that's one of the problems I think we're facing.
Yeah, well, that raises the issue or the questions: what is a journalist, and what work constitutes journalism?
Yeah, that's a $100,000 question, I guess, in today's inflated economy, $100 million question. In my own personal opinion, one of the great sources of power and vibrancy in American journalism is the fact that you don't need to go and get a certificate in order to practice journalism. There's no professional organization that certifies you. Indeed, I think when we talk about diversity in the newsroom, we're talking about a search not only for people from different ethnic backgrounds, but a search for people from different who were raised in different circumstances, different socioeconomic backgrounds, because there's a belief in many quarters that the broader sampling of people that you have doing the work, the better they're going to be able to portray the world. That's a slightly long-winded way of somewhat dodging the question. I was actually asked this same question last night, and I don't feel fully comfortable saying anyone who has the know-how to put up their own website is a practicing journalist, because I do think there is really something fundamentally different between what reporters and editors and designers and copy editors are doing at the Chicago Tribune and what someone's doing at a blog. That said, I'm very happy that I'm not the federal judge that's going to need to eventually unpack all that.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about Jeff Gannon and Talon News?
I guess maybe it's a sad commentary that I was not that surprised that there was essentially a fake newsman in the White House press room asking what also was essentially fake questions. Every administration has tried to control the message to some extent. And one of the things that I think's gotten lost in the revelations of the last couple of weeks is that the Clinton administration also put out these sort of prepackaged news reports that turns out the Bush administration has been feeding to television stations and newspapers around the country. But this administration in particular seems to be willing to go to much greater lengths. And at a time in which there is not a lot of public esteem for journalists and for the profession, having an incident where you have a one-time male escort essentially posing as a journalist in the White House press room and throwing out softball questions I found to be very upsetting and very depressing.
I think that's an interesting, going back to what you said before, I think, Celeste, and also Seth, is that you have a situation where the public at large, I think, has difficulty discerning what we would prefer, what we journalists would call a real journalist, in quotes, and perhaps a journalist who is a self-professed journalist, somebody who's who's a blogger or whatever.
Right.
And you see that extended when you look at television. You see shows coming out of Washington, wherever, where you have talking heads sitting around a table screaming at one another and going on and on about some issue, when in fact, some of them, in my mind, have lost all credibility because they take such strong positions on one side of an issue or the other. They're essentially commentators, but people out there in the public sphere look at this stuff and think it's a news show of some kind, and they really have trouble discerning between what is Eleanor Clift doing, on Fox, And what is a reporter, say, at the New York Times doing, who's covering the United Nations or whatever?
And, or, and not to interrupt, but just what is Eleanor Cliff doing when she's on TV versus what is Eleanor Cliff doing when she's in Newsweek?
Exactly. Yeah. See, that's a tough thing for the public to understand because, you know, the public, they don't sit around thinking, gee, what is journalism all about? What do journalists actually do?
Right.
You know, they don't think that way. They just want to make sure what they're looking for is, you know, information that, okay, to a degree has been filtered. We all know it is in some way or another, but which is accurate and which is as fair and balanced, as Fox likes to say, as you can possibly get it. And I think that's an important element. You know, there's another problem, I think, here with the mainstream media. It's the assembly line nature, I think, of putting out newspaper or broadcast, you know, putting on a newspaper or a broadcast, you know, it's a process that's built on production and not on the values of journalism. So that means, you know, you have to, it encourages speed and volume, but not reflection. And I think that is a real critical component. And I think that's where you can get yourself into some trouble. But
let's talk with some listeners.
Sure.
First caller this afternoon on a cell phone on line one. Hi.
Hello. Quickly about that fair and balanced Fox comment. I wish journalism was more discerning. It used to be that you could trust journalists to go out there and they would get the story from one side, they get the story from the other, but rather than just mimeographing these two talking points back, they would actually weigh the differences and present the truth of the matter. But apparently fair and balanced means that you just show one says the earth is flat, the other says the earth is round, and you decide.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. I think it goes back to what I just said about reflection. Back up one step here and talk to you about something I did for most of my life as in this business, and that was working as a foreign correspondent. And when I started off doing this back in the early 70s, mid-70s, I would go off to a place like Southeast Asia or wherever I might be working, and I would call the office and say, oh, I'm going to go up country. I'll be gone for about 3 or 4 days. I'll call you when I get back or in a week or so. And I would go up and do my reporting, talk to people, sit around, think about what I had seen, what I had heard, reflect on it. You know, organize my notes, and I'd come back to Bangkok, wherever it was I was going to write my stories from, and actually have something I could put in the paper that made sense. The reporters today, they've got cell phones, they have laptops, which have satellite connections, and the desks are always asking them, what do you got now? We've been waiting a half an hour, what can you give us now? So you've got a lot of pressure. The pressure of time is absolutely has increased exponentially from the time when I started working as a correspondent. And I think that's the way it is across the board in all aspects of journalism, whether it's working as a foreign correspondent or covering City Hall. I think that's a real problem.
Although I also just I want to make one quick point, which is that I as I've been out talking about my book, I get a lot of people, one of the themes that people really keep on returning to is the lack of nuance in some of the news that's out there, and what people seem to be talking about a lot of the time is broadcast news and, mm-hmm. and either the cable networks or even some of the network news programs. And I think that some responsibility actually needs to be put on the audience shoulders for that evolution, because the audience, the American public, has shown very clearly over the past decade what kind of product they're interested in. They're interested in a product that has less nuance, that is more simplistic, that doesn't deal with as much international news. The reason that Fox News is so successful is not because they have cast some dark spell over the population, but because there are some very savvy businessmen who realized that here was a product that was going to be that was going to appeal to a very large segment of the population, and that's why their audience is much larger than that of CNN's. It's also why you see CNN sort of chasing after Fox News and emulating some of those same tactics. So I think one of the things that we sometimes forget about, or not forget about, but overlook, is the fact that whether we like it or not, the news media, the news business is a business. And if, in fact, you know, more thoughtful foreign dispatches or more complicated investigative reports were what brought in readers, as opposed to you know, a 5-minute interview with Britney Spears, then we would be seeing that. But the audience has been, for the most part, turning away, and it presents a real challenge for all kinds of journalists who are committed to and continue to try and do the kind of work that they think they should be doing.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Oh, good afternoon. I would like to congratulate you, Celeste, on selecting this topic, or whoever did select it for this afternoon. I have a couple of comments and then a question. I think the comment that both of our speakers have made is about the ability that we should have to the trust in journalism for their accuracy and reflection. And then the use of Fox News as far as a news program, of course, is concerned, is an oxymoron, because what they are is simply a business enterprise. And Mr. Murdoch, you know, is known in the satirical English magazine as the Dirty Digger, is one of the most disgustingly influential persons in the whole world. But one of the sad things is what's happened to news programs, and this was what happened when Walter Cronkite was sort of asked to comment on various news programs to wrap up Dan Rather's career, which I thought was an extremely successful career. He said that the problem with news at the moment is that it has become an entertainment, and the reason that we have to have that is because we have to compete with so many other persons. So I think there really is time where news should be news and should not be, you know, I don't want to hear about the success of gastric stapling in an evening news program. I want to hear what's going on in Bangladesh or Mumbai or somewhere like that. So I wouldn't mind asking your speakers as to how they feel about the deterioration in the content and accuracy of the news. And then as an aside, you know, we're slaughtering the messengers these days, in that the Dan Rather over Mr. Bush's really quite irregular National Guard service, and then the recent interview with him where he admits to using all sorts of interesting drugs. It's the messenger who gets slaughtered, and not the participant.
Well, that's a good. Those are interesting points. I think one thing to remember is the messenger may get slaughtered, but the messenger has a responsibility to get it right. And when the messenger doesn't get it right, perhaps he or she deserves to be pilloried in some way. But let me go back to this other question that you ask. And I always tell my students that there's something that I think that we have a responsibility to do as journalists, and that is you need to provide information that's going to help people make intelligent decisions about their lives, about their choices they want to make in terms of their government, the people that they want to see elected, et cetera. That's what we call public affairs journalism. And what I call that is, I say this is sort of, it's like spinach, you know. I call it spinach journalism. You ever remember your mother saying, here, eat your spinach, it's good for you,
good
you know.
For you, yeah.
You don't like it, but you better eat it because it's really got good things in it for you. And that's what I look at our responsibility as journalists as. We say, here, this is, read this story, read it carefully, read it through, or watch this program, watch it carefully, watch it all the way through,
yeah,
because it's good for you. It's,
yeah,
it's spinach,
yeah,
journalism. And if you don't do it, then you only have yourself to blame.
Yeah.
I don't know, Seth might have different.
I think the only really competent news program that's on at the moment is the PBS Jim Lehrer NewsHour. I mean, everything else is just entertainment garbage.
But it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting that you're when you cite the only competent television news program, you cite a program that does not face the commercial pressures of the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Rather, I agree. I think Dan Rather, when you go on the air with a faked document that you actually had not spent any time to confirm, it's hard for me to feel too much pity for what happened to him. But the reality of that situation is, if he hadn't been in third place, and if he hadn't been in third place for the last decade, he would not have been pushed out when he was. That was as much a commercial decision as it was a sort of tepid slap on the wrist for the National Guard story. I think that we all agree that if we were deciding how the world was going to be run, there would be more public affairs journalism, there would be more investigative journalism, there would be more serious, thoughtful reportage. But just to say that there should be more of this without really looking at the realities of the marketplace, I think, is a little bit facile. And it's one of the really, really interesting challenges, I think, for all of us, for everyone in the media world and everyone who cares about the media in the coming decades, because we are at a point in our culture where no one has found a way to do that kind of really high-quality journalism, certainly on broadcast, and make it be as consistently profitable as, say, The Apprentice or, a special on gastric bypass surgery. That's a scary reality, but it is a reality. And since we don't have public funding of the Fourth Estate, it's something we're going to need to face and deal with. The other example people always use is the BBC. There's some place that's doing good journalism. And again, I think it's not coincidental that the BBC is state subsidized.
Mm-hmm. I want to pause here and reintroduce our program and our guests, and then we're going to go on and take some other calls. Our topic today, recent controversies and issues in American journalism. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. With me in the studio, the Dean of the University of Illinois College of Communications, Ron Yates, and on the phone with us this afternoon, journalist and media writer Seth Mnookin, author of Hard News, The Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media. Let's go on now to another listener caller in Champaign County, Line 3.
Hi, I think you should draw the inference that you're sort of dismissing that we do need some kind of complement to the so-called journalism done by corporate media, and we need some kind of public or licensing fee financing or something like that. Don't throw that out. It seems to me the BBC works in a completely different environment, but they have their own kind of pressures, but that isn't really what I called about. Since you're focusing on the Times in some way, what seems to me that we really ought to be discussing is not so much Jason Blair and fabricated stories, but the fact that Judith Miller, was spoon-fed material from the anthrax being from Iraq at the beginning of the lead-up to the war, throughout the war, through the weapons of mass destruction. No one was fired. They did a sort of mea culpa, but I think two people lost their high-level positions over Blair. But why didn't somebody have to fall on the sword for getting it wrong when it comes to the imbroglio or the disaster in Iraq?
Arguably the two editors that were most responsible for Judith Miller's faulty reporting actually did lose their jobs. They just happened to have lost them before
for a different issue.
I'm sorry?
For a different issue.
Right, but they did. You can't fire them twice. I mean, once they're gone, they're gone. You can't bring them back and say now we want to fire you again for this. I think one really crucial distinction, and I agree with you that the real world impact of Judith Miller's reporting was obviously much greater than the reality that Jason Blair was plagiarizing stories or was saying that he was traveling to Virginia or to Texas and, in fact, was in his apartment in Brooklyn. The crucial difference that I think gets glossed over a lot of times in comparing the two is that Judith Miller never published a story with the intent to deceive. She was taken in by her sources. She was overly credulous. She did not ask the right questions. But she, at every point, believed that she was reporting the truth. She was wrong, and some of the reasons for that are that the editors who had the institutional knowledge and the background and the history to ask the kind of questions that should have been asked had already left the paper under Howell Raines's tenureship. But I think there's a really crucial difference between someone who is trying to perpetrate a fraud and someone who just gets something wrong. That's why people have not talked about Judith Miller losing her job, and you didn't see this sort of public recriminations that you did after Jason Blair. I think it doesn't make the impact any less scary or any less serious, but I think intent in this case does change the nature of the crime.
Could I ask the caller a question? You mentioned something about certification or credentialing or whatever. What are you suggesting? Are you suggesting that perhaps that journalists should be certified by the government?
I don't think I actually said anything about that, did I? I don't recollect it,
actually. I think
that there should be more public financing going into, and I should be isolated, and PBS should have forward funding, so it doesn't have to do the kind of self-censorship that it's been doing all along.
Okay.
So, no, I don't think that the government should be involved in credentialing.
Good. That worries
but
me.
But it actually does in some ways, as we see from the who gets to ask questions in the White House and who gets credentials, et cetera. So there is a sort of a de facto not de jure system of that. But Judith Miller, I mean, she relied on an exile who had a political interest, and she wasn't asked a second source on a lot of things that she asserted. A lot of anonymous sources, that's the only way you can get the story, but no one asked her to get any kind of second sources on a lot of her
also
story.
I mean, I think in one of the things in talking about Judith Miller again, there was I don't want to say no one, but there were very few people, and not just in this country, in Western Europe also, who doubted at that point that Iraq had either the capability to make weapons of mass destruction or had weapons of mass destruction. It was not just the New York Times. It was virtually every newspaper in the country. Now, there were other papers, particularly the Washington Post, that began to correct their reporting and dig a little bit deeper somewhat earlier. But when Judith was starting out on this story, her stories were no different from what was being published in every other American paper and in The Guardian and in the Times of London. I mean, it's not as if there was a real debate at the time. Now, that is a problem, and obviously everyone in the culture made some assumptions that were incorrect. I think now we're looking at it with 2020 hindsight, and
yes,
we're not acknowledging the realities of the situation at the time.
And the other thing is, if you, I'm speaking now as somebody who's been in both worlds. I was in military intelligence before I left that and came into journalism, and I can tell you that, you're going to get information that of that kind, which is obviously collected and protected by whether it's NSA or the DIA or the CIA or whatever, you've got to have sources who, number one, really trust you and will let you see this information. And then you talk about second sourcing it. So if you get this information and it's leaked out to you, say, by a very good source in the CIA or whatever, how do you second source it? Do you go to Iraq and do the on-ground checks? You really can't. Who do you go to? The UN? Do you go to the weapons inspectors? It's really tough to second source a story like that. So at some point, as a reporter covering that kind of the world, you have to rely upon the credibility of the people giving you the information up to a point. And I think where you have a responsibility in writing those kinds of stories is to say, this source is, you say it in your story somehow. You can point out that this is the only source that you had for this information, that you can only you can only report what they're telling you. And beyond that, you know, it's caveat emptor for the reader, you know.
And I think Ron makes that's an excellent point, and it's also something that we're seeing more of these days, and I think in large part because of the frustration on the part of the public over anonymous sources. And you're much more likely now, when you see a source quoted anonymously, to see a second clause of description as to why that is.
Right.
So, you know, said a high-level White House source who spoke on the condition of anonymity because of the sensitive nature of the talks involved or something to give the reader some greater understanding of why it was necessary to rely on someone who didn't feel comfortable being named.
I want to go on to another caller. Let's go and talk with a listener on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm with the last caller, and I don't think your guests have made a valid counterargument at all. The thing with the Iraqi National Congress, and I mean, how much sense does it? How much just plain common sense does it take to figure out that perhaps Chalabi might be planting information with us to make us attack Iraq for his own personal reasons and goals, and maybe make up this whole thing about. I mean, you know, that's just plain common sense. And the thing with Judith Miller, you seem to deny the possibility that there are mouthpieces for the CIA in the mainstream media who are quite willing to be channels for any kind of misinformation and disinformation that the intelligence agencies want to give. I mean, it's really pathetic. It's like the old Soviet news media is what we've got today here.
Can you give a single example of what you're
please.
Talking about? I mean, I love your conspiracy theories,
right.
But I would be curious if you had one single example of a mainstream media source who you feel like is serving as a mouthpiece
right.
for the CIA.
Judith Miller.
I mean, it's so frustrating to hear what I assume are thoughtful and intelligent consumers of the news say something like this. There was not everyone in the world at the time thought that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. There was the entire apparatus of the UN. The Security Commission was focused on inspections all based on the assumption that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. I'm glad that you seem to know that was a complete lie. Neither Ron nor I are trying to serve up an excuse. Neither of us were the people who were reporting these stories.
No.
I certainly wish that they had gotten them right. If you want to try and understand how what happened, I think that either one of us can try and give some explanations of the realities of the news media in an effort to understand. If you are determined to think that Judith Miller is on the pay of the CIA or whatever conspiracy theory is floating out there, then no explanation we're going to give is really going to make any sense. I don't think anyone disagrees that what happened was horrible, and I certainly wish that everyone had gotten the story right. And I think it was a huge failure on the part of the American media. That doesn't mean that you can't look at what happened and begin to try and understand how some of that occurred.
I want to thank the listener for joining the discussion this afternoon. I've got a number of other people waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with a listener in Savoy, line two.
Yeah, hey, I'd like to bring up this issue of credentialing. You know, everyone holds journalists out, and you know, as one of the pillars of our society, and you know, and we depend upon them, and so on and so forth, and they do have a big effect on our everyday lives. you know, here in Illinois, you know, like if you're regulated by the Illinois Department of Professional Regulation, you could have your license taken away for having like 5 parking tickets unpaid. And, you know, I don't see it's a big stretch to credential and license these people if you guys think that, you know, you're operating in the public good.
Let me ask you, let me respond to that. You know, think about this. What we do, people make the mistake of thinking that the First Amendment was written for journalists. It wasn't. It was written for the public. And it's our job, the journalist's job, the media's job, to be a watchdog. In other words, our job, really what we're supposed to be doing is give voice to the voiceless and hold the powerful accountable and on our society. Now, if the powerful are the ones who are giving us the licenses, how are we going to hold them accountable?
Well, you guys, you know, it's if you make a gigantic mistake, shouldn't you weed them out?
But how do you, but who determines that mistake? Who is the one who what body determines the mistake?
Well,
if you've got people who you know, if you've got people handing out these licenses or these certificates, and they decide, you know what, I don't like what Seth Mnuchin is writing. Let's get let's pull his license, you know, so he can't practice journalism anymore.
I don't see why you shouldn't be subjected to right and wrong. You know, like if I build a bridge and it falls down, somebody's going to ask some questions.
No, but there are a couple of things. One, and the point Ron raises, I think, is the most important point, and that's when one of the main functions or one of the most important functions of the press is to ask difficult and oftentimes uncomfortable questions about people in power, trying to license journalists, I think, can get very tricky. And there was a year in which Woodward and Bernstein were were being derided every day to their editors by the White House, and thank God they didn't have their licenses revoked. The other problem, I think, is who decides what is and isn't an organ of journalism. I mean, if I decide that my neighborhood in Manhattan is not being adequately covered, and I go out and write up some stories and mimeograph them on a sheet of paper and hand them out on the corner, am I then going to be arrested for operating journalism without a license? I mean, that's part of the vibrancy of the American press scene and American democracy. The one last point I want to make is that when people screw up, they do get drummed out. Mm-hmm. Jason Blair is not a practicing journalist anymore. Stephen Glass has not been able to get magazine assignments. Janet Cook is no longer writing for the Washington Post. So when you have people operating, when you have people making mistakes, when you have people plagiarizing or lying or cheating, they do get drummed out of the industry. It just doesn't happen to a formal licensing board.
Yeah, we're coming down here in terms of time, the time that we have remaining. And Seth, I wanted to ask you before we have to wrap up here this afternoon about something that comes through in your book, Hard News, and that is a dysfunctional newsroom.
Right.
What does a healthy newsroom look like, and how is this handled within the news media? I think this would be of interest to our listeners.
Well, one of the fascinating things about my book is that the sort of shorthand version that most people had was that the editor of the New York Times, Howell Raines, was fired because of the fabrications of Jason Blair. And one of the things I attempt to explore and explain in the book is that that's actually not true at all. Howell Raines was fired because of the way he ran that newsroom, because he refused to listen to dissent, because he pushed out people who disagreed with some of what he said. He was really a dictatorial and oftentimes tyrannical leader. That sort of answers one part of your question. The other part is, what does a healthy newsroom mm-hmm. look like? I think is much trickier because, as many people have pointed out, newsrooms are dictatorships. You need someone at the end of the day to say, this is going on page one, we're giving this much length to this story, this is what we're going to put on the front of this section, etc. At the same time, and especially in big city dailies like the Chicago Tribune, like the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, you are really dependent on the collective intelligence and the collective expertise of everyone working for that institution. And one of the things that we touched on briefly today was the frustration over Judith Miller's reporting. One of the tragedies was that under Howell Raines, the two editors who would have and likely could have asked those hard questions had left the paper because of their frustration for working for him. Steven Engelberg went to the Portland Oregonian, and Doug Franz left and went to the Los Angeles Times. And they were both experts on weapons of mass destruction and germ warfare and Middle East policy. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting combination of a place that is a sort of benevolent dictatorship, a place that values the contributions of all the employees, and at the same time has a strong leader. And probably the person who's most often cited as embodying that is Ben Bradley, the former editor of the Washington Post.
Just to wrap up, Ron, any thoughts about the culture of the newsroom? And you have to be really brief, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I think somebody wants to describe newspapers, for example, as a nation talking to itself. And I think that that's a pretty good description of what newsrooms should be. I mean, they're really a reflection of the societies, the communities that they serve. And they need to be questioning themselves and each other. I mean, people need to be asking each other questions about the stories they're doing. I think that provides a kind of a check and balance within the framework of the newsroom. But I think newsrooms need to be high-energy places. They've got to be places where people are really dedicated to seeking, you know, truth-telling, trying to seek the truth the best way they possibly can. You've got to be thinking about the trust factor. I mean, that's all you have going for you. The trust and credibility are the two most those are very important elements for a journalist. If you lose your credibility, you've lost everything in this business.
That's where we have to leave it. We're out of time. Seth Mnookin, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Ron Yates, thank you for joining us
this afternoon.
Seth's book, Hard News, The Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media, published by Random House. It's 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, buying frenzy again today at the board in the bean pit, pulling up the wheat and the corn. The corn up 7.5 cents. The wheat were up 14 cents. The nearby May beans up 25, but the far deferred Novembers were up just a dime. Something to be said about that and potentially how that plays into what's happening fundamentally in this marketplace. We'll try to figure some of this out a little bit later. There was a release this morning from Ag Rural, which is a Brazilian consulting firm. They put the Brazilian crop down at 52.3 million metric tons. Now, it was just last week when USDA released its estimate of the crop at 59 million metric tons, and that was down 4 million from the previous one of 63. So this crop is rapidly moving lower in Brazil, not as low as it was last year, but certainly if this is the fundamental move behind what's happening at the Chicago Board of Trade, it might be understandable that the May contract would be up 25 and the November up 10. We'll try to take some of that up and sort it out with Wayne Nelson during the closing market report this afternoon at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock today. But I have to admit that many of our analysts are just simply not sure what's happening in this marketplace, other than that speculators and the funds and the indexes have all gotten involved and decided that they need to buy beans. And up she goes. So we'll run through the numbers as they came across for the day. May wheat now, 369 was the high, the low at 359. 10-cent trading range, the settlement price there up on the top end at $3.68 a bushel. They were up 14 for the day. July futures, 376 the high, the low at 365. Settled at 375, they were up 13.5. September wheat, 380 the high, low at $3.70.5. Settlement price at 380 even, up 14.5. And the December contract, 388.5 the high, the low at 376.5, a settlement price at 388. They were up 15. And the March wheat at 393 the high, the low at 384. Settlement price at 393, up 14.25. Another complicating factor, or potentially a factor that's supporting this, and I heard Dave Dickey talking this morning about it, the CRB index has been making quite a rally lately, and that, of course, measures how much purchasing power there is in the commodities over time, and that has been making a rally higher as well. Now, May corn futures for the day, 231, the high, the low at 223 and a quarter. Settlement price at $2.28.5, up 7.5 cents. July contract at 238 high, low at 230 and a quarter, settled 235 and a quarter, up 7 and a quarter. And September futures, 242 and a half, the high, the low at 236 and one half, settled $2.40 and a quarter cents. They were up 5 and 3 quarters. December corn, 249 and a half for your new crop high, low at 244 and a quarter, settled $2.47 and a half cents. They were up 4 and 3 quarters for the day. March contract at 254 and a half high, low at 250, settled 250 and 53 rather, and a quarter. They were up a nickel for the day. And May corn for next year, this is a 2006 contract, 258 and a half high, low at 53 and a half, and a settle at 56 and a quarter. They were up 4 and a half cents on the day. The May oats, a 158 and three quarter settlement price at 2 and a quarter higher, a 57 and a quarter low, and a $1.59 and a half high for the May oats. From the soy complex, nearby soybean futures traded to the high of $6.84 and a half cents today. Low at 669, settlement price there at 681. They were up 25 cents. July a 688 high, low at 672, settled 684 and three quarters, up 23 and three quarters. In the August, a 686 high, low at 673, settled 682 and a half, up 23 and a half. In September futures, 665, the high, the low at 653, settled at $6.60. They were up 15 and a half. In November, a 650 high, the low at 641, settled 644. They were up a dime. January soybean, 651 to high, the low at 643, settled 645, up 9 and 3 quarters. May bean meal, 203.50, the high, the low at 200 even, settlement price at 202.20. They were up 6.50 for the day, and the July at 204.40, up 6.80. Bean oil now 24.75, the high, the low at 23.93, settled 24.23, up 55. And July bean oil 24.88, the high, the low at 24.10, settled 24.44. And they were up 58 for the day. Here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Prices were higher on the Merc today. March feeder cattle, 106.15 the high, 105.75 the low, the settlement 106.07 and a half, that up 72 and a half. April, 105.15 the high, 104.20 the low, 104.75 the settlement, that up 75. May, 104.30 the high, 103.60 the low, the settlement 103.72 and a half, that up 45. April live cattle, 89.95, the high, 89.25, the low, the settlement, 89.75, that up 65. June live cattle, 86.30, the high, 85.65, the low, the settlement, 85.87 and a half, that up 30. April lean hog, 71.35, the high, 70.10, the low, 70.57 and a half, the settlement, that unchanged. May, 77.45, the high, 75.95, the low, finishing at 77.20, up 85. June lean hog, 79.40, the high, 78.05, the low, 79.05, the settlement, that up 30. July lean hog, 77.15, the high, 76 even, the low, the settlement, 76.82 and a half, that finishing up 20. March bellies, 88 even, the high, 87.50, the low, 87 even, the settlement, that finishing down 60. The Dow is off 18 points at 10,787. The NASDAQ off 12 at 2039. The S&P.